Across the UK, online and on DAB. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
A mid-morning dance with the devil from the Farmer of Fury.
It's more like Boris Karloff.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the Great Dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We are entering a brave new world, ladies and gentlemen, where politicians will only tell the truth, where voters will only vote for people they believe in, and where journalists will ask all the right questions regardless of who is sitting before them. If you believe that, I've got some swampland in Florida to sell you. The campaign proper gets underway this week as the big questions begin to emerge and the big differences between the parties are revealed. Number one, has Nigel Farage cost the Brexit Party a chance to power share in Parliament? We'll be finding out what on earth it is that is stopping him from running as an MP. Number two, will Boris Johnson survive if Brexit Party candidates split the Leave vote? Number three, is the Lib Dem vote collapsing because of clever campaigning by Labour on Remain? And four, could Jeremy Corbyn be benefiting from second referendum voters in the polls? It's still the most difficult election to predict ever, so we'll be getting a host of experts and politicians on to test the waters. Alexandra Phillips joins us from the Brexit Party over in Brussels. Pollster Joe Twyman is here to tell us what the latest voter intentions look like, and Dr. Rakib Hasan from the Henry Jackson Society will be on later to describe why the older vote will be key in December. Meanwhile, of course, we want to hear from you, 0344 499 1000, although we are having a few problems with the phones, so do bear with us if you can't get through. Tweet us as well at Talk Radio, at IROMG. We may not have left the European Union yet, but are we getting any closer, or are we getting a little bit further away? You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Well, there were plenty of politicians being interviewed over the course of the weekend, plenty of people putting out their stalls. Another couple of them resigned, as far as I can see. Another couple of them maintained that they were not going to be coming back. We have, of course, today in Parliament, the opportunity to see who's going to become the new Speaker of the House after the retirement of John Bercow. Keir Clark gets to choose how that one particularly works out, and we'll be following that throughout the course of the day here. We'll be talking to the Resolution Foundation. Charlotte Ivers will be rounding up all sorts of things for us. Ben Clatworthy here is going to be here from the Times. Alex Phillips as well, Brexit Party MEP for the South East of England. I'll be asking her, what exactly does Nigel Farage think he is playing at? First of all, though, let's say hello to Joe Twyman, founder of Delta Poll. Joe, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
So, I saw over the course of the last few days, you've put a couple of tweets out regarding the actual Boris Johnson deal and how people feel about that and which particular parties are willing to vote for it. Tell us a bit about that first.
That's right. We ran a poll at Delta Poll over the weekend and found that Boris Johnson's deal, well, when you ask the general public whether they support or oppose Boris Johnson's deal, you find 33% support, 33% opposed, right, and 34% don't know.
Excellent.
So it is mathematically impossible to divide a country more evenly, yes, than that. But of course, it's not about the national picture as much as it is about the individual parties. Now, overwhelmingly, the Conservative voters favour Boris Johnson's deal. Perhaps no surprise there. But of course, they didn't overwhelmingly favour Theresa May's deal, even though there are arguments about the precise degree of difference between the two. And then, most of interest to me is the fact that among Brexit Party voters, we see that more of those support the deal than oppose it. And this, of course, is in opposition to Nigel Farage's consistent line that this is not a real Brexit and it's not the right deal. And that suggests to me the difficulty that the Brexit Party might have in gaining the kind of foothold that they need if they're going to have anything other than a cursory
this is the kind of one of the main planks, if you like, of the whole election, isn't it? Because Nigel Farage on Friday coming out saying basically get rid of the deal and we can do a deal with the Tory party. Donald Trump sort of more or less peddling that line as well, saying that it's almost impossible to do any trade deals with Britain. That's been defunct over the weekend by Boris Johnson, saying that Donald Trump is wrong about that. What I'm seeing over the weekend is an awful lot of action between Brexit Party voters and Tory Party voters and somewhere in between about whether or not Nigel Farage is doing the right thing here.
Yeah, and that's not good news for the Brexit Party.
No.
I mean, I guess it gets them a bit of publicity, but ultimately they want to campaign on this idea, which doesn't seem to really be resonating. But ultimately, this doesn't come down, in public opinion terms, this doesn't come down to the people who have sat and read both deals, right, in detail and then made copious notes and come to a reasonable, logical conclusion.
Right.
Instead, it's about the feelings that they have around around this. And Theresa May was not trusted by Leave supporters in large numbers. She didn't have the kind of support that that Boris Johnson now has. Mm. And so as a result of that, people taking cues from the leaders are thinking, OK, well, I didn't trust Theresa May, so I didn't like her deal. I do trust Boris Johnson, so I'm more likely to trust his deal. Mm. And that's why I think it's going well. It will be interesting to see whether, over the course of the campaign, whether that situation remains the same or whether this sort of cumulative effect of stories will have an impact.
Well, certainly Nigel Farage's assertion at the weekend that he would not stand as an MP has upset quite a few Brexit Party members, because their view is, if you're the leader of the party, you should be in Westminster. Because one of the things I was going to say, as I said to Julie Hartley-Brewer on the handover before, is that if there is to be a parliamentary Brexit party, because they win some seats, and I've said I think they'll win maybe as many as five or six, but no more than that, really. They need a leader in Westminster, don't they? I mean, it's sort of Ian Blackford figure. Now, you might say that it shouldn't be Nigel Farage. He's going to be too busy. But according to my understanding of the withdrawal deal, basically the MEPs will cease to be MEPs as soon as the withdrawal deal is passed in Parliament. So there's no need for him to be in Europe.
The thing is, the Brexit Party's level of support has been gradually falling since Boris Johnson became Prime Minister. And I think that Nigel Farage has come to the conclusion that he can't win a seat. Mm. And if he can't win a seat, then campaigning for a seat means that he effectively speaks to the same group of people 10 times rather than speaking to 10 groups of people.
Yeah.
And he clearly believes that from a sort of politically pragmatic point of view, he can have more impact speaking to those 10 different groups of people. Mm. Than he can speak.
But are you seriously telling me that the Brexit Party cannot find themselves in a particular seat that they wish to fight, say, for example, in the northeast of England, which has got a 70% Leave constituency, or, say, for example, Wigan going up against Lisa Nandy from the Labour Party? Can they not find a seat that's safe enough for Nigel Farage to win? Because if they it says very little about the power of the Brexit Party.
I think it's very unlikely. I think five seats would be an amazing result for the Brexit Party. I think winning one would be certainly an achievement, and I think it's highly likely,
surely
not guaranteed, that they couldn't win any. Because in those leave-leaning seats you're talking about, the vote for Labour is enormous, and among those Labour voters, it's highly likely that a majority of those Labour voters, even in leave-leaning seats, will have voted Remain. And so, yes, a Brexit Party candidate may take off some of those votes, and they may even substantially reduce the majority that Labour has. But the size of those majorities in those areas and the kind of swing that you would need to get away from Labour is enormous. And so I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying it represents an enormous risk, because it's not very likely. And if you were Nigel Farage, you would probably look at these risks in front of you and think, okay, I could go for this particular seat and work very hard to stand a 50-50 chance. And that's not based on data, I'm thinking simply as an example. Or I could travel around the entire country supporting 20, 30, 40, 50 different
but
candidates.
But he should surely learn from his previous experience, which is with UKIP, when UKIP managed to get about 4 million votes in one particular election, but no seats, because in a two-party, first-past-the-post sort of dominated system, it's very, very difficult to gain that sort of traction. Just ask the Lib Dems.
Yeah, and there's nothing he can do about that. Nearly 4 million votes in 2015... 12% of the vote, one seat. And that was Douglas Carswell, which was obviously an unusual situation in itself.
Yeah.
Nigel Farage has repeatedly tried to win. And he's tried
seven times.
And he's tried to win when, on occasion, much better political circumstances than he's in at the moment.
Yeah.
And he's failed to do so.
I mean, it's interesting what the reaction, as I say, has been. Many Brexit Party voters who voted for the Brexit Party in the European elections have gone to the other side and said, you know, Nigel's wrong on this, we need to back the deal. Even Aaron Banks, right, one of the famously bad boys of Brexit, you know, head of the vote, the Leave.eu campaign, basically says that Richard Tyson and Nigel Farage are engaged in some kind of vanity project and that they need to get on board. Otherwise, Brexit won't happen. They're now effectively being accused of stopping Brexit.
But this is exactly what we talked about at the time of the European elections.
Yeah.
We talked about the fact that this was the closest we had ever never come in this country to a consequence-free election. And so people were able to vote knowing that there would be no consequences to their vote, practically speaking, other than the opportunity to send a message. Mm. This is completely different. This is a first-order election rather than a second-order election, as geeks like me call it. And so, therefore, the implications and the whole situation is different. And there are real implications, both domestically and with regards to Brexit, on this case. And the Conservatives' approach has always been to unite that Leave vote as much as they can by making it clear that a vote for anyone else prevents Brexit and lets in a Jeremy Corbyn government.
Barry says exactly that. He's tweeted, "It's very clear that Farage would much rather stay in the EU and heckle from the sidelines. He knows full well he'll end up splitting the Leave vote, stopping Brexit and piggybacking Corbyn into number 10. Realistic Brexit voters can see this, surely." Well, let's talk about Jeremy Corbyn, because he's had a bit of a boost in the polls over the weekend, it would seem, although it may not be due to anything other than just it's his weekend, you know what I mean? Sometimes it just goes that way. But already people are drawing sort of comparisons and parallels to the start of the last general election in 2017.
Yeah, what I would say to everyone listening, to all the listeners at home, is when it comes to a general election campaign, as at all other times, look at the long-term trends in the polls. Look at the turning points rather than the talking points, because you will have fluctuations along the way. The overall story is that, yes, Labour may pick up on individual days and the Conservatives may drop back, but the Conservatives are still doing very well in terms of their share of the vote, which is considerably higher than Labour's share of the vote. Now, it was a very similar situation last time around, and we don't know what will happen in the campaign, just as we didn't know what would happen in the previous campaign. But 2017 shows the potential that campaigns have to change that polling picture. We saw how the Conservatives really didn't do very well in the campaign, and Labour surged in their polling rating, thanks to events such as their manifesto launch, which went down very well, which was in contrast to the Conservatives. And, of course, in individual constituencies, they were able to say, OK, well, a vote for Labour keeps the Tories out. It's not a vote for Jeremy Corbyn in some areas. In other areas, they're saying, no, it definitely is a vote for Jeremy Corbyn. But the situation at the moment is that the Conservatives are still have a much better share of the vote than Labour. And also, crucially, when it comes to support for Boris Johnson versus support for Jeremy Corbyn, Boris Johnson is well ahead on leadership. He's well ahead on who's best able to handle the economy. He's well ahead on who's best able to handle Brexit. And it's neck and neck, perhaps the Conservatives even slightly ahead, on who's best to handle health, which traditionally has been Labour's territory. And so the underlying data at a national level favours the Conservatives, but it could all change, and ultimately it doesn't come down to share of the vote, it comes down to how many seats you can actually win.
Number of seats, precisely that. Joe, stay with us. We've got lots more to talk about, including Joe Swinson, including what is going on within the Labour Party as well, and which particular seats are going to be, in fact, targeted by both the Tories and Labour to try and get themselves the highest majority in Parliament that they can get. And, of course, as I said, we've got some problems with the phones. If you do want to try and get in touch with us via Skype, by all means, send us a text message to 87222. That will cost you 25p plus your standard network rate. Or tweet us at Talk Radio with a Skype name. We can call you back and get you on the show, because we want to hear your views. But at the moment, technologically, we are slightly in a bad place. But don't worry, because we will still bring you all the news as it happens. We've heard for the moment that Nigel Farage is about to unveil 600 candidates for the Brexit Party, which is going to take some time, I would have thought. That'll take most of the day, I should imagine.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, there's a lot of shifting sands going on and swirling waters around this election, and nobody really feels confident enough to dictate precisely what they think will happen. There is no such thing really as a safe seat. Almost anyone is up for grabs. Even Tom Watson's seat, apparently, at West Bromwich East, is very possibly a target for the Tories. And any number of other things could happen. You know, Hilary Benn could lose his seat. Ken Clark standing down. We're going to elect a new speaker over the next sort of 24 hours or so. Let's talk now, though, to Dr. Raqib Hasan, Research Fellow from the Centre on Radicalisation and Terrorism at the Henry Jackson Society. Raqib, welcome back to the Independent Republic.
Always a pleasure to join you, Mike.
You've been studying some of the sort of trends over the last few days in terms of the way people are voting, the way sort of groups of people are moving around. And it's quite interesting, isn't it?
I think we've got some very interesting shifts going on. Onward, a think tank based in London. They come up with this concept, Workington Man.
Workington Man,
and
yes.
I've written a fair bit about this, the idea that Labour may be vulnerable in its traditional heartlands, in the provincial Midlands, Northern England, and also those deindustrialised part of Wales. Now, when they came up with the concept, you had Lisa Nandy MP saying that, oh, London think tanks, they don't understand northern rugby towns. I'd actually offer the view that some of those Labour MPs representing some of those constituencies, they don't understand their constituents very much either, particularly when it comes to Brexit.
Well, Lisa Nandy's always an interesting case in point for me. She sat in my tent, if you remember, down in Westminster. And said that there was no such thing as a deal, and that the thing that she had voted down three times wasn't a deal, and we had a ridiculous conversation. But she's also a Remainer representing a 70% Leave seat.
Well, this is the thing. If you take Workington, for example, we voted 61% Leave. Since its creation in 1918, the Tories have only won there once in a by-election in 1976. But a recent poll showed that they've now got 11 percentage point lead over Labour. And that's precisely because pro-Brexit voters there, they know where Boris stands when it comes to Brexit, while they're frustrated with the fact that Labour, their position on Brexit is anything but clear. And on top of that, I think they feel that there's a they feel fundamentally disconnected with the general social attitudes of the North London metropolitan elite, which very much dominates proceedings within the Labour Party now. They can't relate to
it.
No,
of course.
Especially when it comes to issues such as immigration, Brexit, issues such as multiculturalism as well. They just feel they're not represented by the Labour Party leadership anymore.
Because one of the things I remember reading about that that Onward sort of description of Workington Man was that they tend to be more traditional Labour voters, more working class.
Tend to be more socially conservative in a sense.
Socially conservative, very concerned about the immigration levels coming into the country, very concerned about law and order.
Perfectly legitimate concerns as well,
Mike. Yes, of course.
Mike.
And very concerned about what the traditional sort of working class representatives of the Labour Party were in favour of. But now they find themselves kind of slightly lost in the whole, you know, LGBT campaigning that goes on.
The regressive identity politics.
Yeah, the regressive identity politics, the kind of, you know, do as I say, not as I do. You know, all this nonsense about please be careful with your language, don't say words.
Pronouns.
Which, you know, I mean, these guys are going down to pub after a rugby league game up in Wigan or St Helens or somewhere like that, and they're not talking to each other like that, I'm afraid.
They can't relate to it. With the Labour leadership, they're more interested in championing diversity, talking about inclusion. But the reality is there are patriotic, communitarian voters in their heartlands. They're not interested in hearing about some of those things. That's the truth. And they feel completely disconnected from the Labour Party leadership. There's this ultra-woke, leftist force within the Labour Party now, which very much dominates proceedings. And that has led to a fundamental disconnect between their traditional voters, who may hold more socially conservative views on issues such as immigration. Right. They're generally pro-Brexit. Quite frankly, they have reservations. In my view, they have legitimate concerns over cultural diversity and parallel communities where essentially they're living side by side, but there's very limited contact or interaction. These are perfectly legitimate concerns, but unfortunately, they don't. The Labour leadership, they're not really interested in hearing about those concerns.
Well, they're not. And I mean, interestingly enough, one of the accusations that's made against the Labour Party and about their kind of policy towards their Jewish members and the fact that they've got a problem with anti-Semitism is that there are those who say that Labour are always trying to target other ethnic groups who might not be actually that upset if they're targeting or being, shall we say, less than friendly to Israeli communities or to Jewish communities or to pro-Zionist groups. You know what I mean? How does that play?
Well, I've got to say, it's important that it's important to recognise that the ethnic minority population in the UK, it's richly diverse in terms of ethnicity and in terms of religion. Another group of voters within the British electorate that Labour aren't doing particularly well among are British Indian Hindus.
Yeah.
Traditionally, they tend to vote Labour, but they feel that with Labour, they're almost unapologetically pro-Pakistan, for example. Labour, at their party conference, they passed a motion which was deeply critical of the Indian government over the issue of Kashmir, where they called for international intervention, and they criticised the Indian government's decision to revoke Article 370, so which granted a special status to Jammu and Kashmir. But there's this idea now amongst a growing number of British Indian Hindus who have shown in recent elections that they're increasingly moving away from Labour and towards the Conservatives, that when it comes to issues such as economics, as you know, that it's a very economically self-sufficient community, very entrepreneurial and business-minded, But also, when you're looking at foreign policy, they feel a fundamental disconnect with the Labour Party as well.
Sure.
So on a number of fronts, British Indian Hindus are thinking, well, traditionally we have a connection with the Labour Party, but is it really the Labour Party that I used to vote for?
The other thing that's interesting to me is the age breakdown as well, because we've heard many people from the Labour Party, others as well, in some of the debates last week, trying to get the vote dropped down to 16. And while at the same time, nobody's making it official, but a lot of noise is being made about why the hell should older people be able to have an influence on what happens in the future, which for me is not only disingenuous and a ghastly thing to say, but also wrong, because it's the age of 60, for example, which is what is being pegged as the age at which you shouldn't be maybe voting on the future.
It's embarrassing.
Many more people are living for another 30 years beyond that, because now the average age is well into the 80s. You know, one of the reasons we can't retire at 65 anymore is because people are living longer.
Mark, I have to make the point, we're talking about a section of the population who have paid into our system for decades. They've contributed to their communities decade after decade. The idea that people are even suggesting to take away their vote is deeply troubling.
It is.
Horribly authoritarian and deeply disrespectful. Mike, I'm of South Asian origin. In our culture, we see, you know, as you become older, you become more
wise. You become wiser.
You know, there's a celebration of wisdom.
In most
cases, anyway. Yeah, in most cases. You know, that celebration of wisdom and also that sense of respect and affection for our elders. And I think that one of the biggest problems I have with mainstream British culture is this attitude of ageism. And this deeply disrespectful attitude towards our elders.
Yeah.
And that has been exposed since the result of the June 2016 referendum.
Absolutely right. Because a lot of rubbish has been talked about how, you know, it's all these old people that have voted for Brexit to, you know, completely ruin everybody's future. When in fact, there's no evidence to show that anybody older voted more for Brexit than they voted to remain. You know, it's a pretty even split, it seems to me.
I mean, I think I'd make the point that with Brexit, people have tried to, you know, generate and disseminate these sweeping generalisations. So, as you know, we talked about my recent think tank report. We looked at Britain's young Eurosceptics.
Yes.
There are young people who did actually vote to leave in that referendum.
Well, I'm sure there are plenty
of
young
older people who actually voted to remain
of
as
course.
Well.
Well, so, there'll be plenty of older people who voted to remain, because that's all you ever see on the buses that come to London when they have a march, right? And they're all very much over the side of 65. Similarly, in places like the northeast of England, where they had big leave votes, there'll be an awful lot of people in their 20s, working class kids, who voted to leave.
The reality is that this idea that we would take away the vote from older sections of the population, which is being suggested by younger people, deeply authoritarian, it just strikes me as something. It just shows the moral decay that our society has suffered more generally, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Yes, I think that's the problem. What do you make of the way the campaign's been going so far? I mean, interesting statistics there from Charlotte, our political correspondent, saying that actually it looks very much as though over the course of the last weekend, polls are suggesting that the public trust Boris Johnson more to run the NHS than they do Jeremy Corbyn. Now, if that's a result of Jeremy Corbyn saying that they're going to campaign to save the NHS, that's pretty bad news for Labour, isn't it?
It's terrible news for Labour. The reality is, if there's one issue that Labour had historic ownership over, it is healthcare, and specifically the National Health Service. But it's interesting that Labour, at their conference, they passed a motion which essentially, it was calling for the removal of all restrictions for migrants to access the healthcare system and more generally the welfare state.
Yes.
And I've always made the point that you need to have a nationally cohesive society in order to support and sustain these ambitious collectivist projects, which the National Health Service is.
Right.
So when you're talking about the NHS, it's also those sort of issues also come into it when people say, who do you trust more when it comes to the management of the National Health Service? But I think that's very encouraging for the Conservative Party, who are already showing signs that they're going to come up with these ambitious infrastructure projects. They're very passionate about, you know, funding public services. So there's the idea, it's almost a mixture of red and blue. They might be socially conservative when it comes to controlling immigration, for example. They might talk more about a more nationally cohesive society. They'll be more open about the drawbacks of multiculturalism. But when it comes to economics and public services, Boris might try to attempt to take the Conservative Party in a more social democratic approach. And that could be very appealing in those traditional Labour heartlands who did vote Brexit, and they may be more socially conservative, but they do care deeply about their public services.
Right.
And they do want the people who need that support from the welfare state to be well protected.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work. If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
I hope someday we'll sit down together and laugh with each other about these days, all our troubles.
Now, we haven't actually got a countdown clock to the election yet, have we? I'm getting heads shaking behind me in the glass. So we don't need a Brexit countdown clock. We need an election countdown clock. Can we please get an election countdown clock organised so that I know precisely every day how much closer we're getting to the election? And it'll speed up, slow down, you know, as the campaigns go through. We will bring you all of it here, of course, at Talk Radio, because we are your election station. Mr. Chris has tweeted, he says, so good to hear someone of South Asian heritage talking about the various South Asian communities in the UK. So knowledgeable and interesting. Makes a change from being told about them by what white men and women think. I think that's absolutely right. There's no way that you would put all white people in one political group. So why would you put all non-white people in a political group? And that's what we get Dr. Raqib Hassan in here for from the Henry Jackson Society, because that's important. Let's talk now, though, about a lot of things to do with the election. But one particular thing outside of the election, which has caught my interest as a media sort of specialist. And I've got Andre Walker here, columnist and Talk Radio presenter, of course. Andre, welcome to the Independent
Hello.
Republic once more. Lovely to see you. It's getting a bit febrile out there. And it could get even more febrile with the news that I read this morning that Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's sort of former chief advisor, is interested in buying the Daily Telegraph.
Isn't that marvellous?
Well, it could well be.
it sent people absolutely crazy.
I bet it has.
I worked with Steve Bannon when we set up Breitbart London together with a few other people. I don't want to take undue credit.
Yes.
Look, he's a phenomenal person. He's a phenomenal media star. And he's somebody who understands working class voters. Not every, you know how you were just saying, not every white person votes the same way, not every Asian person. Look, not every working class person likes Steve Bannon's politics, but these are people who've been fundamentally neglected.
Yes.
And I would argue that the Daily Telegraph has been neglected. You know, it is heading, I don't want to be rude, it is heading towards bankruptcy. It'll make 900,000 this year.
Right.
It was sold for 625 million 10 years ago. It's now worth 100 million.
And they're trying to sell it for 600 million, which they're not going to be able to do. Are they? I mean, this is it's owned currently by the Barclay brothers, who are two what can only be described as rather odd and slightly eccentric brothers who live on the island of Sark in the middle of the channel, and who have now kind of of gifted the running of the operation to their two sons,
yes,
who, make no mistake, are also quite elderly. They're in their sort of mid to late 60s. So it's a very traditional newspaper, formerly the Tory kind of mantra paper, but no longer.
But look, I don't want to sound like I'm favouring a sister publication to Talk Radio, but look, but you know, if you look at what the Times has done, the Times is much more pop. Well, it's much. I think it's a much better product.
The Times is far cleverer. It's far cleverer. It is far more modern.
Yes.
And it represents far more views, I think, than the Telegraph, doesn't it?
I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does. And then when you go to the mid-market, you know, you've got the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, and then you've got the Sun for kind of, you know, the white van man type people.
Yeah.
But and then you think, well, where does the Telegraph fit into all of this? Now, with Breitbart, you know, whatever you think of Breitbart, good, bad or indifferent, when we came to London, or when it came to London, I was clearly already here, when it came to London, you know, it really, really developed a huge following absolutely overnight. It was something like, during the Brexit referendum that year, it was the seventh most shared UK website on Facebook.
Yeah.
Now, that is a phenomenal thing for a website that had been simply unheard of a few years before. Now, in terms of the background at Breitbart, remember, although the deal had been done between Steve Bannon, Robert Mercer and Andrew Breitbart, Andrew Breitbart really died before the deal was properly put through and before he made any difference. So it was really Steve Bannon on his own
How does Breitbart fare these days? Is it still kind of as popular? I mean, come this election, for example, how important will it be?
I think it's less popular. I think it's settled down a little bit. Mm. I think you needed the Steve Bannon push in there. But look, they've still got James Dellingpole as their chief columnist in the UK, and that's a pretty big name.
Right.
In fact, I think I'm right in saying that Dellingpole was the most popular writer they had worldwide because of all of his views on climate change and whatever. So I think it is still big in America. It's not as big, but it's, you know, the shame for Breitbart, as far as I'm concerned, is I think Bannon really would have pushed it forward.
Yeah.
But when that book came out, where clearly Bannon had been, let's just say, indiscreet about Donald Trump, that's kind of where it ended
for him. And
then
it sort of fell out with Trump, and Trump was then quite disparaging about him, as he is with anyone that he sort of falls out with, which is absolutely basically everyone.
Well, he called him Sloppy Steve, which was a reference to Bannon's dress code. But I warn you, don't look that up on the internet, because he accidentally said something quite rude.
Yes, I wouldn't want to do that. What about the likelihood of this happening, though? Because Bannon isn't a wealthy enough man to come up with that kind of money.
Well,
so
well,
it's
you
a
say,
question of what he puts together, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So he declared being worth $48 million when he went into the White House. You know, there's these statutory declarations.
Right.
So obviously not rich enough to buy it on his own. Presumably he's not in with Robert Mercer anymore after the falling out. I don't know whether that's true or not, but Mercer presumably could have bought it and would have done.
Yeah.
Beyond that, look, he used to work at Goldman Sachs. He used to work at Goldman Sachs in London.
Yeah.
And he reputedly owns a percentage of the TV show. Is it Frasier or Seinfeld? I can't remember.
Okay.
But it's one of the two.
Right, which make quite a bit of money on reruns.
Absolutely.
What about his kind of his sort of partners in things like the Leave campaign, possibly the Brexit party, people like Aaron Banks, those kinds of people who are obviously very wealthy. Wealthy backers of the Brexit party.
You were about to use the phrase partner in crime, but clearly you didn't mean that literally.
Actually, no, I wasn't. I was going to say something else which should have been worse, so I just stuck to partners. But anyway, nevertheless, who does he know, I suppose, is what I'm asking, who would pass the right and proper test, which is what inevitably the authorities in the UK would want them to do.
I think the problem you would have with Steve Bannon, and I don't know all of the Brexit Party people and all the UKIP people, but, you know, generally it's said that Aaron Banks is the richest of them.
Yeah.
And Aaron Banks, I suspect, and Steve Bannon in the same room, whilst they might get together well to start with, I think that would end badly. They're
too
both incredibly, incredibly headstrong, incredibly my way or the highway. I don't think it's necessarily ego. I think when you are that sort of person, you're built up from nothing, you are quite a robust kind of character.
I think we've all been in rooms with these people, and not many of them like to be told what to do or being given advice, which may or may not be unsolicited. You know, they prefer to go, like, this is what I want to do. How are you going to help me?
That's
when people go, well, actually, no, this is what you have to do, and this is what I can do, then they go, I don't know.
But I think the reason, I think to answer your question properly, I think the reason that Steve Bannon is talking about it being a global brand is because I think that he would find it easier to find an American hedge fund billionaire, of which he knows lots, than find somebody in the UK.
And also, interestingly, I was thinking about this when I saw this story, that, you know, he's probably, whoever buys it now will have to be not buying it for the purchase of a printed newspaper. They'll be buying it for the title, for the internet site, for what they can do worldwide, I suppose, with video, you know, with audio, even maybe with radio, on something which is a new kind of right-wing site.
Absolutely. And I think what you've got, if you were to be, if you were to consider being a Bannon investor, you've got a former investment banker who is used to putting together media deals, who, you know, finance shows in Hollywood, and also has set up his own media company, effectively set it up. I keep saying this, Andrew Breitbart set up Breitbart, but effectively, Steve Bannon is the person that made it what it was. You know, that sounds to me like a good bet.
And does he have credibility, do you think, in the city from that point of view?
Well, the big problem, the big risk, I think, would be that there would be a boycott Telegraph campaign.
Yes.
Now, the question is how severe that would be. Mm. And forget the readership. It's not about the readers. It's about the advertisers.
Yes, right.
What they start doing is they go for Heinz beans and say, you are advertising with this right-wing publication. Mm. And the advertisers start to bail. Look, I think firstly, I think he will be looking for sugar daddies.
Yeah.
That's what he did with Robert Mercer and Breitbart. And I think when you're talking about £100 million or $110 million, there are people who spend that per year on political campaigning in America out their own pocket.
It doesn't mean very much at all in terms of the money.
The Human Zoo, where they don't hide away the sick animals.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
On Talk Radio.
Not sure you want her as the spokeswoman for the Brexit Party, but that's another story. I'm not sure which way she's going to vote. We've got loads of you who want to talk to Alex Phillips, who's here, very kindly hanging around, even longer than we thought she would. Thank you, Alex, for that.
We've got
the phones working. I love being here as well. I love it better when the phones are working as well. Jerry is in Burton-on-Trent. Hello, Jerry.
Hi there, Mike.
How are you doing?
Hello.
Oh, I'm fine. Just really enjoying the programme.
Good.
Absolutely superb.
Brilliant.
I enjoy entering the Republic with full vigour.
Well done.
Superb. The only thing is, I'd just like to get across to Alex. We really do need a clear message to sound against Boris's claim about us coming out. And the problem is, I think from the Brexit side of things, to make it really clear what the distinct difference between both camps are and make sure that message comes out. Because Boris doesn't make any points that Alex made just earlier about the distinct difference. So is there going to be some approach to making certain that the polarity between both camps is really emphasised through the campaign?
I couldn't agree with you more, Jerry. In fact, I want to smash my head against a wall and say, why are we not owning the airspace and telling everybody why this treaty is so awful? But we've only just begun. We've got 6 weeks now to really fight them on this. Personally, I wish we had started doing it early. I wish we had had a couple of weeks head start and been able to sort of expose this treaty for what it is before we get to the point of nominations. And that way we might actually find the Conservatives buckling under pressure. But they are worried. And I'll tell you why I know they're worried. You just have to look at people like Steve Baker, who I admire greatly. The former hard man of Brexit is what I'm going to call him, because he's become the soft man of the treaty these days.
He won't like that.
Oh, no, I do like Steve. He's got a good sense of humour. But you know, we've got people like him turning around. They're all clubbing together going, no, Nigel, this is terrible. If they thought that Nigel had no impact or no relevance and wasn't speaking the truth, they wouldn't be coming out knife sharpened to go after him. This is the Conservative Party doing what they do so excellently. And you have to, you know, dock your cap to them. They are very bound together, very tribal. They usually have very good hierarchy, despite having 11-odd people in the Tories who went a bit rogue and didn't chime the party line over Brexit. Usually the Conservative Party will put blue before anything, and I suppose you could admire them for that, but I don't think it, you know, that shouldn't come by compromising your nation's future. There's a time when you have to say this is a one-off exceptional circumstance. And the stupid thing is, actually, if the Conservatives did do a deal with us, they would end up with more seats themselves than they would do running against us. But it's this weird sense of pride that they can't do it. But as you were saying, Jerry, we need to come out and make it very clear why this treaty is bad. We haven't done enough yet in that direction. We're starting off on the back foot, and people have bought wholeheartedly the idea that it's a fantastic new deal, because that's what Boris has been saying. But, you know, we are only just starting this campaign, and the next 6 weeks are going to be very interesting. My little analogy, which my dear friend Nigel has stolen from me and is using it liberally, is rather like a piece of cheese kept out of the fridge for too long. After a while, when this thing's given some daylight, it's going to start to honk.
Some French cheese honks even when they give it to you at the beginning, though. So, you know, maybe you just pretend it's French. How about this from Danny, who says, Mike, what a fantastic case Alex has put forward. I was leaning back towards Boris Johnson's deal, but she's completely changed my mind, and now it's back to the Brexit Party.
Yay!
So you're obviously working. Jerry, thanks for your call. We're going to run. Frankie's in Whitechapel. Hi, Frankie.
Hello, Mike. How are you, my old mate?
Very right? Well, sir. Very well. What can you tell us?
Lovely, great show as usual. Alex, I've got to tell you, love, I've got to take my hat off to you, my little darling. I've got to tell you, it cannot be easy being a woman who's been absolutely proactive in trying to get us the way that we should have done in the first place 3.5 years ago to get us out.
Oh,
I really take my hat off to you, because I've got to tell you, Nigel, what he suffered in the way of even taking his kids out to go and have a meal, a bit of grub on a Sunday in a pub, being spat at.
Yeah, I was there that day.
Abused, absolutely diabolical. I am disgusted at some of these personalities that call themselves Democrats in our very own country. And a woman like yourself, taking it forward, taking this message forward, it cannot have been easy. Now, let me just finish and then you can crack on.
You got a question at the end of this, Frank, have you?
600, what are they calling them, Mike? 600 colourful
candidates.
Characters that could be destroyed as far as their character personalities are concerned. Have a look at the 600 that are already in there.
Yeah, too true.
It's not a bad thought,
Frankie. I mean,
look
at how many people in the Labour Party have been chucked into prison or, yeah, you know, been paying for rent boys. Right. They've got a leg to
well,
stand
listen,
on.
Well, listen, I mean, the only reason Keith Vaz is not going to be in the next Parliament is because he's been suspended and he won't be able to stand in this election. Otherwise, he would have been back.
Yeah, all that, the woman with the ankle tag in Peterborough.
The one that voted Brexit down.
Yeah, and the gingerhead chap, the red-haired man.
Yeah, you're not allowed to say that. The Tories have just kicked out the guy from up in North in Scotland, who, of course, denies the charge.
Oh, and, Mr. Touchy-Touchy.
Touchy-feely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all going on. Yep. So, you know, absolutely. So, Frankie, what's your question, by the way?
Well, my question is this. Nigel, he is not that stupid, and there's no way that he ain't got a plan up his sleeve. And I'll tell you something else, Mike. I'd rather that man out there on the road campaigning, because that man is like a ball with a... He's literally like a ball... like a ball in a glass shop, because what he will do, he will go around and he will... All he's got to do, really, is create every paragraph that's damning towards our policy about this treaty that Bojo's trying to sell to us, and publish it on every billboard, every bus stop, and let everybody scrutinise exactly where we've been carved up. That's all he's got to do.
Well, he's been beginning to do that, I think, on social media. There is a tweet that's going around that Nigel Farage is kind of, you know, speaking over, isn't he, and highlighting bits of the treaty that you don't like, effectively. But as I said, there are others who will say that actually his interpretation of that is not entirely what it should be. And that, in fact, you know, there are several good things about it. And I think you're wrong to say that loads of people are going around saying it's a great deal. I don't think people are saying it's a great deal. But I don't think what they want is another period of uncertainty and more kind of, you know, delay and more negotiation with an organisation which has proved itself to be not exactly easy to negotiate with.
Well, no, I understand that completely. But the thing is, if that treaty goes through, that's what we're going to be in anyway,
right,
with the transition period. We're still going to have 3 years of this, and we're going to have 3 years of that while they impose on us whatever they want, which
but
is so dangerous.
But that's inevitably going to be the case anyway, isn't it? Because that's the other thing. I mean, a lot of those who, up until you came on here and made a very good case for it, that I've been talking to on Twitter, have kind of been those who I would say are much more, shall we say, adversarial towards Europe. They don't like Europe. They don't particularly want to leave with good terms. They don't really want to have anything to do with the European Union. And in the end, that's an unrealistic place to be, because, of course, we're going to have to deal with them. We're going to have trade deals with them. There's no reason that we have to snub our noses at them and throw rolls at them or anything like that. I mean, you know, we can deal with people, surely, in a mature way and leave in a mature manner, which preferably is with a deal, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, yes, I agree with all of that sentiment. Of course I do. But... Do you know, it pains me to say it, but I would rather go through the pain and the agony of a couple more years or a couple more months, whatever it takes to do this right, than an eternity as a satellite of the EU. I couldn't forgive myself. I couldn't do it to my nation. I couldn't do it to, I was going to say, the point about me being a woman in politics, don't worry, I've made my down payments on spinsterhood. I have two cats, one called Mob and one called Murdoch. Okay. So.
Well, who's looking after the cats while you're on the campaign trail?
Oh, I've given, well, Murdoch is now with my mum and dad. Okay. In Gloucester, and Mog is in Brussels, and I gave her a big load of food.
Okay.
So hopefully she'll survive until tomorrow.
Probably so. Now, Mark says, if the Brexit Party will not win a single seat, but in the meantime will split the Brexit vote and potentially let Corbyn into number 10. The Brexit Party has done a great job so far, but will not be forgiven for enabling Corbyn. And I think that's the way an awful lot of people feel. We've got time to squeeze in one more call. Andy's in Littlehampton. Hello, Andy.
Oh, hello, Mike. Thanks very much for squeezing me in.
No talk, no problem. What do you want to say?
Well, look, to Alex. Alex, I can understand what you're trying to do, but look, listen, don't you think it was naive, political naivety, Nigel coming out in his opening speech with all guns blazing, pushing Boris back into a corner where he could only say no? I mean, surely you understand political optics, but Boris to have said anything but no, he would have had to have trashed everything he's done in the last 100 days at the beginning of a general election. It's not going to happen. Well, there was no compromise whatsoever. And lastly, Alex, if I may say, if you'd gone for 30 or 40 MPs, which you probably would have stood a good chance of getting, that could have been a game changer. You could have well been the second or third largest party in Parliament, and you could have changed from within. But you've taken almost a pound shop route to a cheap, nasty route to achieve this.
If I could answer you on both of those points. First of all, I don't think we did go in all guns blazing, because when we first made the offer to the Conservative Party of a non-aggression pact, it was very open-hearted and generous and warm. And let's not forget, there will be conversations that have been had behind the scenes as well on this. The person who I think is actually being politically naive is Boris Johnson, because what he's doing with this treaty is trying to get rid of a political problem now and kicking the can down the road. And I think if that treaty is signed and goes through, what you'll find in a year's time is the public will never, ever, ever forgive him for what he has done to this country. Now, in terms of the argument about seats, and I've said this already during this programme, in an ideal world, I agree with you. It would be great if we didn't have to field candidates up and down the country and could target 30 or 40 and be very strategic like that. But we can't do that, and I'll explain why. The system is designed so you can't do that, because if that was the case, then any small party that comes out of nothing or independent candidates could demand to be in leaders' debates, they could demand to be on Newsnight and Question Time and the BBC 6 o'clock news. You have to, if you're going to be considered a political party who's taking part in this election and gets any sort of coverage, you have to put forward a full slate. Now, we have said to the Conservative Party for about 2 months now, we will work with you, we'll do a non-aggression pact. And they're the ones who turned around and said, Nigel Farage is not fit for office. I mean, if anything, I think we've been very humble in this situation, and they've given us very little choice. And the stupid thing is, they know that if we had a non-aggression pact with them, it's a surefire way of them getting even more seats. So I don't really understand their mentality, other than the fact that it's true blue pride. It's we can't be seen to do anything with anybody else because they've got the entitlement of an establishment party.
Andy, I've got to let you go. I can't let you answer that because we're out of time, unfortunately. Alex, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks
Pleasure.
For staying. I'm so glad the phones worked so you could get a flavour of what the people out there are saying. But you'll find that out over the course of the next 5 or 6 weeks anyway, I dare say, out there on the campaign. I will be manfully fighting off man flu today and tomorrow, and I'll be back at 10 a.m. After I've recorded a few podcasts and done a few other bits and pieces. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. This is Talk Radio. Remember, it is your election station.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1 Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.